The snipe demons are out to get us.
Yeah, I must have evoked the wrong ones.
For tuning into Panopticon, a podcast which explores various elements of the occult, culture, and consciousness. And now your host, Andy.
Greetings and welcome to episode 7 of Panopticon Podcast. This evening we have with us on the line Iao131, who is the creator of the Journal of Thelemic Studies. Hello, Iao, how are you?
Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law.
Love is the law, love thy will. Why don't you just go ahead and tell us about yourself?
Well, I'm a 22-year-old Thelemite living in California. I've been into Thelema for probably 7 years now. I'm a member of the OTO and the AA, and I've always been interested in the writings of Thelemites, obviously Aleister Crowley, but more modern Thelemites, and how Thelema has developed over time and grown. And the journal is really just a medium to allow Thelemites around the world, potentially, to basically share their ideas and their thoughts on Thelema, on Aleister Crowley, on magic, and basically the journal provides a forum for that, because the basic idea of the journal is to have a nonpartisan center, where what I mean by that is the journal isn't explicitly pro this or anti this. It's simply there to allow people to voice their views if they are coherent and well written, and that's basically the entire idea behind the journal.
Yeah, it's really, really well done. I started reading it in 2007, I believe, and I was instantly impressed by it, because there's a lot of, you know, obviously with the internet people can kind of publish whatever they want. That's a good and a bad thing. But the journal is one of those kind of rare instances within Thelema and the occult, and, you know, specifically people who are interested in Crowley. It's one of those rare instances of a very rational, sane, well done work. So thank you for making it. Can you tell us what the process has been like? Maybe what kind of led you to starting it, and what it's been like for you personally and as a member of the Thelemic community?
Sure. Well, first of all, the internet has been a big role in my life in general, and also learning about Thelema. So when I first started learning about Thelema, I looked online, read all of Crowley's works online, because I couldn't find certain books, or they were too expensive, because I was a student.
Right.
And in that process, I also found the publications of local OTO bodies, which had a lot of good stuff in them, but they were also, I thought, mixed in with work that wasn't as high quality. And so, in general, I wanted to create something like one of those local publications, in that they showcase the local Thelemites' creativity, but also have a high standard of the quality of the material submitted, that the people even use references when quoting things or making certain points. If their writing is well-structured, those are all the qualifications I look for. And in doing this, I received a lot of support just for the idea and a lot of submissions. I also got a lot of crazy emails telling me the solution to the puzzle in the second chapter of the Book of the Law and all sorts of crazy theories. So it was definitely interesting to look through the different submissions and where all these different Thelemites are coming from, what is, you know, what's interesting to them and what's exciting them enough to write an essay about it.
Yeah, I just reread your essay on Thelema and Buddhism, and yeah. I really enjoyed it. That was one of my favorite pieces from the journal. And
thanks.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. And I also just reread last night your, I feel like a jackass, I can't remember the title of it. It's an essay that's up on your website, and it talks about Nietzsche and Carl Rogers.
Thelemic Values.
Thelemic Values, right, exactly. That was great. It reminded me, actually, this Carl Rogers character reminded me a lot of Wilhelm Reich, actually.
From
what it sounded. I've been a big fan of Reich for quite some time, and the whole organismic evaluation of experience. And, you know, one of the things I'd like to talk with you tonight about is Thelema.
Sure.
Itself. But I guess what I wanted to ask you is, what is the meaning of the phrase, "Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law," to you?
Well, my first response is to say that every individual has to come to an understanding of that phrase along with every other line in the Book of the Law. And personally, my understanding is constantly changing with new insights, reading different material, reading more of Crowley's material. So just first of all, I think each person should come to their own understanding of will and also recognize that that understanding will change. But in my own personal opinion, not to be too much of a center of pestilence, but I think primarily do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law in one aspect is a statement of freedom in that the one principle we have to follow is our will, which is essentially the following out of our true nature. And in doing so, we essentially relinquish ourselves from all these different burdens of what is good and evil, what is right to do and wrong to do, including all of these old notions from the old aeon, including the vices of drug use, of sexuality, of even skepticism and rationality. And so I take it in one sense to be freedom from all those restrictions and to say there is no law beyond do what thou wilt. There is no God going to judge you for being not the perfect saint. I mean, you'll endure consequences from acting stupidly like anyone else, but there is a freedom from this notion of sin, eternal judgment, from even the most basic sense of shame and guilt about our own actions, in this fearing that they're sinful or wrong or unethical, something like that. In another sense, in a more positive sense, it's a calling to each person, the old saying, know thyself. To do your will, you have to know who you are. People can do what they want, but is that what they really will? There's a dichotomy in Thelema that's often brought up, that will is not want. And so it implies this level of introspection and self-awareness and self-discovery that's necessary to keep pushing through the veils that have been set up through cultural conditioning. And so I see it sort of as a twofold, freedom from restriction and freedom to be what you really are, what you can really become. And I think the will is really an expression not of our conscious desire, but of our entire being. It's sort of, if we consider our entire being, mind, body, spirit, however you want to divide it up, as one whole, one noun, then the will verb to that noun is the motion of our being.
Okay. What do you think is involved in the process of finding what one's true will is?
Well, it's a lifelong process, and I don't personally think that the true will is something you uncover under a rock and suddenly you have it, or suddenly you have a clever phrase to describe yourself and then it's over. I think it's more of a process and more of, like I said, a verb that can be dynamic. But you can also find out the nature of that dynamic verb in the sense that, in the very basic sense of self-analysis, do I really want this? For example, there's a practice in Phonema called saying will, where before each meal or any kind of drink, you do some symbolic knocks, and you ask, what is thy will to eat and to drink? And then the person responds, to what end? And you say, to fortify my body thereby. And then they say, to what end? And just that question, to what end, is a good practice. You analyze your actions and your desires and ask, to what end? To what end? And just this plain analysis, you can see that there's tons of contradictory desires and motions that are basically pulling you in all different directions so that your net result is basically staying in the same place and stagnating. And so just the process of self-analysis is necessary in discovering the will. The more traditional answer is that there are the practices of magic, ceremonial magic, and yoga that have been passed down by Aleister Crowley, who essentially scoured every single spiritual system for the essence and gems and reproduced these teachings and these practices in various writings, often in the Equinox, which he published. And you can find them basically consolidated in the book Magic, or Book 4, where Part 1 deals with mysticism, yoga, Part 2 deals with magic, Part 3 deals with the theory and practice of magic in more depth, and the fourth part deals with the Law of Phonema, which is overarching and basically guides all of your actions in magic and yoga.
Another question I had for you is, what, in your opinion, is meant by the phrase, love is the law, love under will?
Well, again, it's a complex idea. This is my personal opinion, that the love mentioned is not what most people take love to mean, which is a sentimental, emotional idea. And rather, love is the law, love under will. Love refers to something which is greater than that idea. It doesn't exclude it, it includes it, but it includes other things as well. So Crowley essentially says that love is union between any two things, specifically the union between oneself and one event and one's environment. So each event that one experiences is an example of love. Now, that plays into the metaphysics of Phonema, where in the Book of the Law, it says the world was essentially created for love's sake, for chance of union. And in this way, it's a reaffirmation, I guess, that all things in this world are of the nature of love, meaning different combinations, different meanings, and it also has the more poetic sense, love in the more poetic, passionate sense. So, in union with an event, this is love, but the line says, love is the law, love under will. So basically, in each moment, there are essentially infinite possibilities of love in each moment. But what guides us is the will, and what is the fulfillment of our nature, and instead of a restriction or inhibition of our nature. So in each moment, we use our will to love. And that also means that the nature of will is love. So Nietzsche had a idea of all things are the will to power. All things are one thing overcoming another. One way I like to think about it is Phonema views everything as a will to love, as a will to unite. And there's also a more mystical sense, because the word yoga also means union. If you read Crowley's 8 Lectures upon Yoga, he'll repeat the phrase, yoga is union, something like 8 times in the first chapter. And so the idea of love as union ties into the idea of yoga as union. So in the chapter, he starts talking about how, as mentioned earlier, how love is the nature of all things. Crowley explains that often with the chemical metaphor of, even in the chemical world, of two elements uniting into a third is an example of love under will, because that's a fulfillment of their chemical nature. But he also brings it back to the more mystical sense that yoga is understood by people like Swami Vivekananda and other yogis who essentially strive for what we in the West call union with God, what they call samadhi or kensho and nirvana, all those other great terms that they seem to have infinite amounts of.
So, in a more mystical sense, what is the law of their will is a call for each of us to reach that consciousness of samadhi, which is a non-dual consciousness beyond the duality of self and object, between subject and object, between any two things, really. And so it ties in with the more Western notion of the great work. Quote says the great work is the uniting of opposites. It may be understood under the figure of male and female uniting, of spirit and matter uniting. There's a whole bunch of different metaphors that are used, a lot of symbolic metaphors too. So, in my personal interpretation, love is the law of love and will is, in one sense, a very practical view that we should view each of our actions as an example of love and try to direct those actions under our will. And in the other sense, of a call to achieve samadhi, to achieve the great work, and come to know that self that is beyond the normal ego self.
Yeah, that's great. If I felt I needed to add anything, I would. I have another question. This is getting into more speculative areas, but how does the lima fit into modern culture, the modern world, and maybe like politics, you know, society?
Well, I think the lima has a lot to offer culture in a lot of ways. In a extremely mundane sense, as I mentioned before, the lima offers a freedom from a lot of the cultural taboos and restrictions that plague people. And so in a social sense, it offers a view of humanity and of interaction between people that is free from the dogmas of sin and shame and guilt over silly concerns over virtue and vice and sin and eternal punishment. There's also the sense that, more personally, in being open about sexuality, about all these other things that are normally considered sinful or taboo, it allows for a culture of non-repression, where nowadays we repress what we really think, what we really feel, what we really want to say, and all of these other things to create basically a false persona that we interact with the world, and we push down our actual feelings and desires, and basically become repressed, we become neurotic. And so in those senses, I think, socially and psychologically, it offers a lot of freedom. In another sense, it offers a paradigm. In this world we live in, it's just, in at least the Western world, it's very secular, and I want to almost say nihilistic or hedonistic, and I don't say that as a judgment, it just is. And what I mean by that is that people essentially just follow whatever is in front of their face. And they have no meaning. The normal meaning of God has been cut out from most people, as Nietzsche most eloquently stated. And most people just don't have a source of meaning or direction or purpose in the world, or even an orientation in the world. And the lima offers all of those. And I think it offers them in a way that doesn't fly in the face of, first of all, common sense, and second of all, modern science. So we're not preaching some dogma where the world was created when it obviously wasn't, or the world came from somewhere it obviously wasn't, or all these other different superstitions. And, yeah, I mean, it places you in this world where you are a star in space. Each star has its own will to follow, and each star has duty to perform that will. And that gives meaning, purpose, direction to people's lives. There's also the other sense that Lima is extremely rich in potential for culture, along with the fact that these practices essentially release the genius within each person that's expressed, I believe, through creativity in the sense of writing, music, poetry, or even drama, dramatic ritual. There's all different ways to express it. And just the more practical side, these practices can lead to people becoming what they really are, what they can really be, and allow people to fully express themselves. And I believe that if people follow out these practices, they will essentially not become more creative, but become more in tune with their inherent need to create, make something beyond themselves, express themselves in the world.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I couldn't agree more. Also thinking more along the lines of politics, it seems to me that the monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, really seem to operate quite well in a patriarchal or monarchical authoritarian political system where there's one god, one king, one ruler, and that kind of hierarchy. And whereas Thelema, it seems, would probably best function within an anarchist society or a cooperative, non-hierarchical society. What are your thoughts on that?
I think there are elements that are anarchical, including the respect of each person's beliefs and also the general distrust of authorities making decisions for you. But there is a lot of hierarchy inherent within Thelema, within the holy books, and within the orders that exist nowadays. Now, that may be a throwback to the old aeon, but I believe that in an ideal world where everyone was doing their true will, Crowley says, each star would go on its way without clashing. And in that ideal, it may be possible to attain some anarchic collective ideal. But the fact is that even Thelemites are still working to understand their true will, and we need a practical system to deal with the facts of life. And I think it's interesting to talk about the ideals of Thelemic politics, but at the same time, I often see people will basically look into Thelema as a mirror and see their political views reflected back.
Yeah.
And so even that fascistic element of this is the one law and all must adhere to it, people can read that into Thelema.
Yeah.
And also the opposite, people can read that into it. I personally have a hard time seeing a specific political system in the sense of just straight anarchy, straight democracy, aristocracy. None of those seem to fit exactly well within the paradigm of Thelema. But I think in a very practical sense, there are a lot of changes that could be made to our system now, especially in America, that would be much more in line with Thelema. So the respect of the individual, for example, I think most Thelemites can agree, even if there are a lot of ambiguities about politics, that, for example, we should all have the civil liberties of freedom of speech and such. And we can get together to work towards fighting for that. But I'm often torn between the ideal political system where, say, we had some island set up and a bunch of Thelemites thrown in there, what would the politics look like? And then torn between that and, hey, we're in a world where we're immersed already in a political structure and we have to work within that and work to change that.
Okay, no, very good. Can you tell our listeners about your book, Naturalistic Occultism?
Well, as a Thelemite, I am interested in magic and ceremonial magic, obviously. When I read through Crowley, I saw that he was different than all the other occultists that I had read, in that he tried to apply what he understood as the scientific method. And he wrote this journal, the Equinox, where the motto was the method of science, the aim of religion. The book essentially focuses on the same occult phenomena that everyone is used to, basically systems of Kabbalah, astrology, invocation, and even mysticism like yoga. I try to treat naturalistically. The idea is basically to view the same phenomena but with a naturalistic eye, a scientific eye, and a pragmatic eye. And so I think these are all things that are inherent in Crowley. So in Libra O, he'll say something like, I'm speaking of the planes and the spheres and the paths and all these different things, but it doesn't really matter if they're true or not. By doing certain things, you will get certain results. And that's the pragmatic view. If it works, that's provisionally true. And a lot of Thelema, or at least a lot of Crowley's writings, has this same view. So in Magic and Theory and Practice, he is talking about the astral plane and astral beings that appear to the magician. And basically the question is, are they external to the magician? And he says, our maxima of truth is essentially maximum convenience. So if it is convenient to speak of an angel as a being separate from ourselves, speak of it that way, but you don't need to entertain the whole metaphysical system of external angels and hierarchies that actually exist in the world. Also, just in a more practical sense, if there is a phenomenon, say you have a vision, then if there is a psychological or neurological explanation that makes any sense, I believe that one should be the first to be considered because it's in modern mind. It's in line with modern science, and just because when we give a supernatural explanation to something, it's essentially the end of the conversation, essentially saying we don't know where it's coming from. And in the past, what we've called supernatural has pretty much always turned out to be some natural phenomenon that we just did not understand at the time. I think that's also true for a lot of things. Like if you have a vision and say, oh, it came from God, that basically doesn't mean anything. It doesn't solve anything. It doesn't help anyone. It just means you've submitted to a dogma. We can experience these visions and even take lessons from them, but we don't necessarily need to be superstitious about what they imply in the sense of supernatural beings, supernatural forces.
Okay, very good. What's coming down the pike for you? Do we have another issue of the journal coming out soon?
Well, I've been working on the Speech in the Silence podcast.
All right, let's talk about that. Tell me about that.
Well, Speech in the Silence is basically a podcast run by the group in San Diego, where the focus is Thelema, Alistair Crowley, and OTO, Ordo Templi Orientis. And the idea is to get basically people who are authorities in the field to give lectures, to do readings of Crowley, and also to have music. So, in a sense, it's an expression of Thelema culture, a consolidation of all these Thelemites' views into one place. Right now, it's only material from OTL initiates, and it's focused towards Thelemites that are already somewhat familiar with Thelema and want to learn more about it. But there are also segments that are introduction to OTL, introduction to Thelema. And so basically the idea is to essentially have audio vehicle of Thelema and to help promulgate the law, let people know about the law, and come to understand it.
Yeah, it's really well done. I've listened to most of them, and yeah, I really appreciate it. I will definitely put a link to it in the show notes for this show.
Yeah, that's great.
I just thought of something else that I'd like to ask. What do you think is the place of groups like the OTO and the AA within Thelema? Is it necessary that people be a member of the OTO or the AA? Or, I mean, can you speak to that?
Well, my personal opinion is there is no law beyond do what thou wilt. And it's any person's choice to join any kind of group, Thelemic or not, especially Thelemic, and to basically unite themselves to that order's purpose. Now, I personally think that the OTO is the foremost public face of Thelema in this world at this time. It may be that in the future another order will rise that is more pervasive and more structured and more in line with the new Aeon, but that's not how it is now. I personally think it's a great force to both spread the Thelema in the world and to come to know it in yourself through the initiations and the Gnostic Mass. So I wholeheartedly encourage people to check it out, but it's definitely not a necessary thing for all Thelemites to do. People should really just read up on see in line with what they want to be doing and check it out.
Okay, great. So let's see, we talked about the Speech in the Silence, and what's going on with the journal and your writings and stuff. What's coming down the pike?
Well, the journal's been on sort of a hold for a while, and I've been moving around and such and working on other things like the podcast. I'm not sure if another issue will be coming out. I've actually been talking to a few other members of the OTO with the idea of coming out with a newer journal with a more comprehensive peer review board and probably longer issues. So if I get enough submissions, and it seems right, another issue will come up.
Great.
I personally believe that the quality of the submissions counts way more than simply putting out a bunch of material.
Absolutely. Yeah, and one of the great things about the journal is that it's not an official newsletter of the OTO or any group. And I think if it were, I might be skeptical that would maybe be a reason that there wouldn't be, say, criticism or views that are perhaps antipathetic to the current, you know, leadership and that sort of thing. So that's a really great thing about it.
Yeah, I mean, the idea was to unify all Thelemites, OTO or not. And so it is open to anyone that wants to voice their views. And there are articles in there. I literally just disagree with, but I think they're written well enough and they show enough support for their arguments that they are valid expressions of philemic studies and should be published. So, yeah, I mean, criticism is welcome and opposing views are encouraged even.
Okay, yeah, that's great. What is your thoughts on is philemic culture at this point in time too dependent on Crowley as a personality and kind of a Crowley fan club? I know that's kind of a loaded question already, but...
It is sort of, but I think there are a few dimensions. There are people that are focused on Crowley's personality, to the exclusion even of what he really said, and they will focus on Crowley essentially as a badass and as someone who they wish they were, which is, in my opinion, totally antithetical to Philema. We're not trying to imitate Crowley. We're trying to live our lives and be our own people.
Right.
But I think there's actually a dangerous tendency to think that Philema should move beyond Crowley and basically cut out the branch from under ourselves and basically say, well, Crowley was good for his time, but we have to do what's good for our time. Now, that's valid, but I think Crowley was not only ahead of his time, but extremely initiated in his insight. And I have read his works over and over and over again. Each time I read them, it's something new, some new insight. And so there's always stuff to go back to. He certainly was prolific enough that his work will probably never be exhausted in terms of referencing it and building on it. So I think that Crowley is extremely important to Philema. He is the prophet of the new aeon. He is even the logos of the new aeon. Yeah, it's just a strange balance between focusing on Crowley, who basically gave us the fundamentals of Philema, and also, yeah, we live in a modern world. Things change, and we need to adapt. And so there are new things that we need to do, we need to say. Some things might need to be revised, but I personally think Crowley is absolutely invaluable to Philema, and it wouldn't be Philema without Crowley.
Okay, that's good. I personally was attracted to Crowley from the outset when I first just totally dove into the deep end of Crowley's writings several years ago. I saw from the outset that he was a brilliant synthesizer of the world's traditions. And he had done a lot of work exploring the world's traditions and was bringing them together, you know, bringing Eastern and Western philosophies together. And here's a guy who had really done the work to explore what we already have. And I was also, of course, aware of the fact that he was so, you know, sexually liberated and did, you know, lots of different chemical compounds, but to me, that wasn't what I was attracted to. Mm-hmm. And I kind of winced around people who it seems like they're into Philema or Crowley because it's like a rebellion against, you know, their parents or something. You know, whatever, I'm not into pointing my finger or sending out bad vibes. I'm just saying that personally, I think there's a lot of people who don't really read his stuff. There's a lot of people who haven't read John St. John, you know? A lot of people who haven't actually read 777 or Magic and Theory and Practice, even.
Yeah, totally. I mean, there's a huge amount of people. They're not huge, but there's a lot of people that are into Crowley and occultism in general as a reaction to their upbringing, and they see in Crowley essentially the opposite ideal of the restriction they grew up with. And so basically Philema becomes a way for them to act out against their old selves or their parents or something like that. Just the titles, or they like the symbolism, they like the fact that astral beings are being spoken to. That's all very glamorous. And people get caught up in all of that glamour and instead don't remember what they started there for, or they get interested for, I believe, wrong reasons, which is, you know, to become like this cool outcast who knows some rituals.
Right.
Instead of trying to really understand the world and understand yourself and using these rituals as tools to do that.
Yeah, I think there should be more focus, which, you know, whatever, who gives a shit what I think, but I think there should be more focus on people focusing on their actual wills. I've hung out with, you know, groups of Thelemites in different cities across the country, and it seems like a lot of times we weren't talking about our own wills. We would say, you know, we would talk about the will in general, but you wouldn't hear a lot of conversation about specifically, like, I'm going to go to graduate school, or I'm going to go to India, or I'm going to write a book. You know, we would sit around all night and talk about, like, the Sephiroth, but, you know, very little talk was about actual wills. Yeah, that's one thing I've been working on the past couple of years.
I agree also in a more subtle sense that talking about these philosophical ideas such as the will is often not even practical or helpful at all. Sort of like saying, paint a picture. And like, well, what should I do? Well, painting itself is this. And like, well, learning about painting doesn't tell me what I should paint right now.
Yeah.
So I think, I don't know, it often applies where people will say, oh, well, is this and that, but when you turn away from the conversation and realize you're still in this world living here, how does that change what I do? What should I be doing? What should I actually be practically changing?
Yeah, and I think for a long time, and if somebody out there feels this way, that's perfectly fine. But I think for a long time I felt as if doing the work was starting out the day with Resh and then Elber and then LHR and then meditating and then LHR and then Elber and then, you know, reading books. But I kind of realized that my will isn't to do rituals. My will is to, for me personally, it was to finish college and be able to get a job where I could make enough money to travel the world, which is what I really want to do more than anything, you know?
Right,
and I didn't think of that as being the work, which is weird because that's exactly what, for me, it is.
Right.
So it's easy to get really distracted by all the different symbols and metaphysical ideas, and don't get me wrong, don't eschew those things, but make sure the focus is on your own will, I guess, is what I'm saying. And I know you know that, and that's why I'm talking about it with you.
Yeah. I mean, when I say doing the work, I really just mean integrating all of this stuff into your day-to-day life.
Right.
And, lots of people say, oh, it's well to do ritual, and in my opinion, you're doing ritual to find your will.
Yeah. And to properly place yourself, you know, what's the point of doing Resh? It's to properly calibrate your presence on the earth in relation to the sun.
Right, just to come into a harmony with nature.
Right. Well, hey, man, this has been really great. We went kind of everywhere I wanted to go. Is there anything else you want to add about anything you're doing or anything you want to tell the listeners?
Well, I have a blog at yao131.wordpress.com. I might be posting some more stuff there.
And people can buy your book, Naturalistic Occultism, at Lulu. Is that right?
Yeah, it's Lulu, lulu.com/yao131.
All right, fantastic. Yao131, do what thou wilt, shall be the whole of the law.
Thanks for having me. Well, with the law, love under the law.
Absolutely, it was a pleasure.
Yeah, it's a beautiful new aeon.
It is, it absolutely is. All right, listeners, that does it for Panopticon Podcast Episode 7. We thank EIO131 for coming on the show and enduring the Skype demons, which tried but failed to thwart our conversation. And we encourage you to check out EIO131's blog, as well as the Journal of Thelemic Studies, and to check out his excellent book, Naturalistic Occultism. And finally, we wish you, dear listener, a delightful evening. Peace.